Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Stephen Zunis, and he will be speaking on UN and Middle East. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
Moment of silent prayer and meditation. Thank you. I'm Stephen Zunis, and this is the last of 2 weeks worth of seminars or workshops or whatever you call them here that I've been doing in the Middle East. I will be leaving later today, inshallah, which is the Arab expression meaning God willing. Our car's at Fields Point, so. I wanted to talk about the United Nations, which has been very active in the Middle East. I want to talk about four conflicts where the UN has played a major role. Cyprus, Western Sahara, Iraq, and Israel-Palestine, and the neighboring Arab states there, including Lebanon. Since I've talked a fair amount about Israel-Palestine, I will say that for last, because some of these other conflicts are very interesting and very few people know about it. Since Cyprus is a little marginal, I'll start there and just go real quickly, that Cyprus is an island in the eastern Mediterranean. Geographically, it's a part of the Middle East and Asia, though culturally it identifies more with Europe. About 80% of the population is Greek-speaking and Christian. It was a British colony for many years, and upon independence in 1960, they were divided between those who wanted to become, you know, another island of Greece, along with Crete and the other Mediterranean islands, and the Turkish minority, who, seeing how the Turkish minority had fared in parts of Greece, and likewise the Greek minority in parts of Turkey, wanted some kind of partition. The partition idea wasn't very popular because the populations were interspersed. The Turkish population on average seemed to be a little more in the north, but again the communities were all blended in each other. They were concerned they'd be oppressed by the Greek majority. And a compromise was reached where Cyprus would become an independent federated state. It would not become part of Greece. In fact, the Greek Orthodox Archbishop by the name of Makarios became the president. But there is quite a bit of intercommunal fighting, and the United Nations came in on several occasions to keep the communities apart. The United States, during the Johnson administration, tried to pressure Cyprus into a partition. And I remember this famous story of the Greek ambassador meeting with Johnson, and Johnson saying that you should partition the country. And he said, with all due respect, Mr. President, Greece is a democracy, and the Greek people would never accept something like this. And Johnson exploded into a rage, and I'll do the edited version of it, since it included a fair amount of obscenities, but said, listen, Greece is a flea, Cyprus is a flea, and the United States is an elephant, and that elephant might find you a little pesky and whip those fleas with its trunk, and your democracy won't be worth whatever. And within a year, there was a right-wing military coup in Greece, overthrowing the democratic government. The colonel who was in power, a guy by the name of Papadopoulos, happened to be this CIA liaison with the Greek military. But in fact, this Greek military happened to have a more hard, Papadopoulos' successor in the junta, having had an even more hardline view on Cyprus, and encouraged a right-wing coup in Cyprus, which overthrew Makarios. He barely escaped out the back window of his home. And this was in 1974, in August. And fearing for the, and announcing an intention to merge, Enosis, in the Greek word, become part of Greece. And this led the Turks to launch a full-scale invasion of the island, taking over the northern third of the island, including half of Nicosia, the capital, so like Berlin prior to a few years ago, and Jerusalem prior to 1967. It was this capital city divided right down the middle. And tens of thousands of ethnic Greek Cypriots from the northern third of the island were forced out of their homes. Thousands died, civilians. The United Nations immediately called for Turkey's withdrawal. The UN, seeing Turkey as a NATO ally, however, rejected any idea of sanctions or anything to force the Turks out. UN peacekeeping forces were sent just to patrol the dividing line between the two countries. However, Congress did muster enough courage to have a U.S. arms embargo, but President Carter succeeded after a very hard lobbying effort in lifting the arms embargo, saying that it would encourage the peace process. But in fact, what it did was has rigidified the Turkish position, and the northern third of Cyprus remains occupied by Turkey to this day, and it remains a divided country. And the UN peacekeeping forces have been largely, in effect, reinforcing that partition by keeping the sides apart along that line. So that's one major UN operation in that part of the world. Any questions about Cyprus before moving on? Okay, another one, which is a real critical one, which very few people know about, is a country called Western Sahara. I'll try not to talk too long about this because I just finished writing a book about it. But Western Sahara is a country on the Atlantic coast, just south of Morocco in northwestern Africa. It used to be called Spanish Sahara, or Rio de Oro is another name for it. And just on the verge of receiving independence from Spain in 1975, it was invaded by Morocco. Mauritania, which is a country to the south and east, also took part in the initial invasion and partition of the territory, though they eventually withdrew, and Morocco took over the whole thing. But it's been under Moroccan occupation ever since. The Western Saharan government, which is recognized by more than 80 countries, has been largely in exile. In fact, most of the population was forced into refugee camps in western Algeria in the desert. And I visited those refugee camps. In fact, I traveled with the guerrillas in the occupied in the liberated zones of the territory that the Western Saharan government still patrolled. Fascinating movement. They are. They rejected Marxist-Leninism. They are actually quite democratic, they're devoutly Islamic. They've been very progressive in terms of the role of women. In fact, they're women leaders in the government, cabinet officers and governors and the like. And they've been struggling for their independence. The UN, again, condemned the invasion, called for Moroccan withdrawal. But the U.S. blocked any kind of sanctions. In fact, 1975, when all this took place, our ambassador to the UN, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is now a senator from New York, said, in reference to this, and another case in Southeast Asia involving an invasion by a U.S. ally against a small neighbor, "The task given to me by the State Department was to make the United Nations as ineffectual as possible in dealing with this matter. I took upon this challenge with no inconsiderable success," end quote. So willing to go on record supporting international law and the inviolability of international boundaries, but we refused to do anything about it. Indeed, in the subsequent years, initially under Carter, followed by Reagan, U.S. aid to Morocco increased dramatically, including direct support and counterinsurgency operations, advisors, radar surveillance, and others to try to crush the government and country of Western Sahara. But even though the Moroccans had a military advantage, the cost of this counterinsurgency warfare, the fact that the Western Saharans, through their revolutionary movement known as the Polisario Front, refused to give in, they finally agreed to have an internationally supervised referendum in the territory. And ceasefire was declared about 3 years ago. Unfortunately, the UN peacekeeping force has been moved into Western Sahara, which includes some Americans, to try to keep the peace. The problem, however, is that the Moroccans have been not allowing the UN to patrol its occupied territories, where there's widespread political repression of the population continues. They've continued to violate the ceasefire, but the Moroccan's main allies, the United States and France, have refused to lessen their military aid to try to pressure Morocco to stop these activities. The main obstacle, however, is who gets to vote, because the Moroccans have moved in tens of thousands of settlers into the occupied territory, so that Moroccans now outnumber the indigenous Western Sahara population, again, since most of the indigenous population was driven out of the country. And so, according to the UN document, the refugees are able to return and vote, and people of Moroccan origin are not allowed to vote. The Moroccans have been tracking down anybody in Morocco that has at least some Saharan ancestry, which is not too difficult since this is, you know, southern Morocco and western Sahara, and you know, nomadic tribes, you know, going back and forth for a while, and claiming that these are eligible voters. And normally the king would be, they couldn't get away with this. But there's a slight problem in that this is all under the directorship, this whole peace process is under the leadership of the Secretary General. And the Secretary General, as Egyptian foreign minister, was an outspoken supporter of Morocco and its claims to Western Sahara, whereas all the rest of the Organization of African Unity saw this as a clear-cut case of aggression. Egypt, along with Zaire, were the two countries that really held out to support Morocco. And it's apparent that Boutros Ghali is using his own, it's not risen above his national, his own government's interest in the matter to be a truly objective Secretary General, as many people had hoped. So that remains stalemated. And it's a real human tragedy, particularly given that I personally am very impressed with the Western Saharans, and I think it would be a very good thing for both the Arab world and Africa to see a real grassroots participatory democratic movement and be able to have power, not to mention the very dangerous precedent it is of a country invading and gobbling up a neighbor. Anything about any follow-up on Western Sahara? I'm just curious, how many people had heard of Western Sahara before today? A few people, yeah. That's good.
What's the Moroccans' justification?
Basically, it's part of Le Grand Maroc, Greater Morocco, which, as neighbors point out, also includes parts of Algeria, all of Mauritania, even parts of Mali and Senegal. It's basically the king's megalomania in action. They justify it somewhat by the fact that there are some tribes in some parts of history that pledge loyalty to the king, but the International Court of Justice, the World Court in The Hague, ruled that this does not constitute an act of sovereignty. And clearly the right of self-determination takes precedent over, you know, some ancient, you know, chieftain, you know, pledging loyalty to some ancient Moroccan king.
You said that they could trace their bloodlines back. They could claim to be able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
What system are they using? Are they just using people's word that they are this tribe or this?
It's basically, the king's word, which is not, which is fairly questionable. He's clearly trying to tilt the vote, because if it was a free and fair election, the people who are honest to God, Sahrawis, people of the area. The Union of Morocco would get some support, but there's a little question that independence would win out overwhelmingly, despite pouring in millions of dollars to get essentially buy the hearts and minds through building up the area with social services and the like.
What is the population in the area?
It's very small. It's a very, very tiny country. We're only talking about maybe 300,000 people total. Again, most of them are in exile. And then plus an additional 100,000 or so Moroccans who've come in since then.
Well, and how large is the area?
About the size of Colorado. So it's and we're talking about desert here. This is a very underpopulated area. Has quite a bit of mineral wealth, phosphates and others, and may be able to live well. a very, very rich fishing grounds, and it's a pretty prosperous area. But it's not much in the way of agriculture or, you know, anything like that. It's very arid. The third area is actually, let me go to Israel-Palestine. The United Nations have been involved there from the beginning when they found themselves just 2 years after the UN's founding, faced with this dilemma between the Jewish community in Palestine and the Arab community in Palestine, both claiming the right of their own state, self-determination, both of whom had been promised their own state by the British, who were the colonial power. That's why it's often referred to as the twice promised land. They took upon a Solomon-esque solution of partitioning the country in half, kind of a checkerboard fashion. 50% going to Jews, 50% going to the Arabs, with Greater Jerusalem, including Bethlehem and some of the Ramallah, some of the towns in the surrounding area, being part of an international UN-controlled zone. To do this actually went beyond the authority of the UN General Assembly, so it was pretty controversial from the beginning. It was also controversial because it gave the Jews half the land when they only controlled 6% of the land at the time. So vast areas that were overwhelmingly Arab were to become part of this Jewish state. Indeed, not a single third world country, with the exception of the Philippines and Liberia, which were essentially a neo-colonial relationship with the United States, supported the partition plan. But at that time, of course, most of the third world was colonized. They didn't have their own seats at the UN, so the European powers and the North American countries were able to get a majority. Israel was partitioned. The Jews began tried to drive the Arab population out of their sectors. The Palestinians tried to drive Israel out of existence. And in the ensuing war, Israel ended up taking over 80%, not just 50%, but 80% of Palestine. And the Arab areas were reduced to what we now know as the West Bank and Gaza, which were incorporated into Jordan and Egypt, so the Palestinians never got their state. And the UN came there to try to mediate, help with the refugee crisis of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were driven out of what was had just become Israel. And the first UN representative, Bernadotte, who I believe was a Dane, was assassinated by a right-wing Jewish terrorist group. And recent documents have suggested that the person who ordered the assassination was none other than Yitzhak Shamir, who was the strongly U.S.-supported Israeli prime minister, who was just defeated 2 years ago in that election. The UN peacekeeping forces were there, including in downtown Jerusalem, which was right there in the middle to observe and monitor the ceasefire. And UN forces have been set in subsequently as other wars expanded Israel's boundaries and have tried to get the sides talking as much as possible. The UN UN Security Council has passed many dozens of resolutions on the Middle East. The most famous, of course, are UN Resolutions 242 and 338, which call for Israeli withdrawal from the territories it seized in 1967, including in return for security guarantees from neighboring Arab states. In other words, land for peace. Initially, Israel seemed to accept this idea, and the Arab states rejected it. Now it's pretty much the other way around. Most Arab states support it, and Israel rejects it. One reason the Arab states initially rejected it is they didn't support Palestinian self-determination. It didn't even mention the Palestinians at all. It merely said a just solution to the refugee problem. The Palestinians argue, we're not just refugees, we are a nation, and we deserve a right to statehood every bit as much as Israeli Jews do. But the United States, along with the British, who wrote this document, 342-338, said, no, let's see it as a refugee problem. The United States insists that these be the only operating, this be the basis of the peace negotiations. So all the other UN resolutions, such as 181 and others, which recognize Palestinian statehood, according to the U.S., should not be a factor. Only the one resolution that doesn't should be there. The two resolutions, 338 is essentially the same as 242, should be the operational ones here in the peace talks. And even now, for the first time, we have a U.S. administration in Clinton, which is even distancing itself from 242 and 338, arguing that Israel should be able to hold on to at least some of the occupied territories. And has rejected, for example, Syria's. Syria is now in compliance with 242. They said, okay, you withdraw from the Golan, we will demilitarize it and bring in UN peacekeeping forces, land for peace, just what the U.S. said, the United Nations said, but now the U.S. and Israel are saying that's not enough. There have been several resolutions calling for essentially reiterating 242 and 338, but with the proviso that there'd be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. The U.S. has vetoed those resolutions. The U.S. has actually vetoed more resolutions, the Security Council resolutions, in the past 25 years that were critical of Israeli violations of international law, such as its invasion of Lebanon, its repression of the occupied territories, its illegal settlement activity, and all vetoes by all members of the Security Council in that period combined. So the U.S., like in Morocco, as in Western Sahara, has severely limited the UN from action, and of course has rejected any idea of sanctions against Israel to force its compliance with these resolutions. In response, the General Assembly has taken on more and more stuff. Now, the General Assembly, unlike the Security Council, doesn't have enforcement power, but it can sort of get, you know, pass resolutions giving a sense of what the world community feels. And in reaction to the sort of this diplomatic umbrella that the United States has put on Israel, over the years they passed a series of anti-Israel resolutions. Some of them had some real validity regarding human rights violations and violations of international law and the like. Some of which were in themselves valid but incredibly hypocritical. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a lot to teach Israel about human rights, for example. others were just plain ridiculous. And the classic example was during the United Nations decade on against racism and racial discrimination, the General Assembly passed a resolution saying that Zionism, which is essentially Jewish nationalism, is a form of racism and racial discrimination. And this was passed back in 1975 in the fall. And it really divided the community, because on one hand you had people saying that, you know, that Zionism is inherently racist. On the other extreme you had people saying, oh, Israel is incredibly democratic, has never done a single racist act in his life, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the reality, of course, is in the middle that, yeah, the Israeli government has many racist policies. A lot of racist things have been done in the name of Zionism. There's a lot of racism among Israelis. But, you know, but Zionism, like any kind of nationalism, has its racist chauvinistic elements, militaristic elements, but also some very inclusive, pluralistic, inclusive, you know, elements. And to lump the entire Zionist movement into its more right-wing camp, you know, was clearly unfair, and many people would argue anti-Semitic. So the General Assembly, anyways, these kind of things have made the Israelis very distrustful of the UN, and sort of reinforced that kind of internalized oppression that many Jews feel, that the whole world is against them, the whole world is after them. And it's given Israelis excuse to dismiss the UN, even when criticism and actions by the UN were indeed legitimate. The UN has given the Palestine Liberation Organization observer status in the UN, similar to SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, the Liberation Movement for Namibia, prior to Namibian independence, which is to say they can't vote, but they can be present, take part in debates, and they can be part of various UN agencies. When Palestine declared its independence several years ago, they are recognized by the majority of members of the UN, but the US clearly veto any kind of membership. Indeed, when Palestine tried to join the World Health Organization, which is a UN agency, the United States threatened to withdraw all funding and support for the WHO, which is about 25% of the WHO budget, which would have had a disastrous impact in terms of AIDS prevention and oral rehydration programs and you know, the kind of things that would have affected the lives of millions of people. The U.S. felt that strongly that Palestine should not be part of any UN agency. So the UN has been somewhat limited in what it could do in terms of enforcing international law, but they have in many ways kept the various sides apart. Scores of UN personnel have been killed in the process, primarily by Israel's Lebanese allies. The Israelis have sort of a foreign regiment called the South Lebanese Army, which has harassed and killed scores of UN troops. But UN personnel have also been killed by Palestinians and Israelis and others as well. But it has been a real struggle, and the UN's been frustrated particularly by the United States and its refusal to allow it to enforce its resolutions. So that's why when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the United States went to the UN saying that this kind of aggression is untenable, intolerable, and the UN must take strong action, this new world order, to protect the inviolability of borders, and the UN's credibility is at stake because we can't allow one country to seize land in a part of another country. A lot of people looked at the U.S. and saying, what? You arm Turkey, you arm Morocco, you arm Indonesia, you arm Israel, and they invade and occupy their neighbors and thumb their nose at the U.N. And now the U.S. is getting real self-righteous about the U.N., international law, and enforcing the inviolability of international boundaries and right of self-determination. Give us a break. But most of the UN still realize that, the U.S. may be hypocritical, but aggression is aggression, and we might as well at least be able to do something. At least the U.S. won't block us on this one, so let's take the only stand we can take, and that is insist that Iraq withdraw. Now, it's interesting that the language, the immediate and unconditional withdrawal, is the same language the U.N. has on record the Security Council involving Morocco, involving Cyprus, involving East Timor, which is in Southeast Asia, and involving Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon. But in this case, the U.S. said we have to enforce it by sanctions. The people said, fine, we impose sanctions. And then the U.S. said, that's not enough. You need to give us the authorization to use force. Well, the United Nations Security Council wasn't so sure about that. They want to see sanctions give a chance to work. They looked like the Soviet Union and China was going to veto. So the United, this is just a couple months after the Tiananmen Square massacre, and heightened awareness about the repression in Tibet, speaking of an occupied country. And basically Bush said to the Chinese, we'll continue your most favored nation trading status, despite all this, if you don't veto this resolution. Meanwhile, the Soviets are cracking, again, speaking of self-determination, the Soviets are cracking down on the Baltic states at that time. I mean, I remember that awful incident, I forget if it was in Latvia, Lithuania, but there's some repression going on there as the independence movements there grew, and the U.S. said, again, we will keep quiet about what you're doing there if you support us on this. Well, even if you get, and France and Britain were ready to support us already. So that's the five permanent members. And any a veto by any one of those five could kill the whole thing. But the U.S. wasn't home free yet, because you have nine other members of the Security Council, which don't have veto power, but were enough to... defeat the measure. Most of these are third world countries. And this is now public record. The United States went to these countries and said, basically, if you support us, we'll increase our foreign aid. If you vote against us, we'll cut it off. And these countries were, many desperately dependent on U.S. foreign aid. So they were able to muster a slim majority for the use of force. So the UN, you know, did for the first time since Korea, gave its okay for the for member states to have a use of force. But unlike Korea, where at least it was done under the UN flag, this was, you know, gave individual states license pretty much to do what they wanted, which again was an unprecedented act, and one that came frankly through bribery and extortion. Since then, the U.S. pushed through a number of resolutions saying that before we could lift sanctions, Iraq had to pay war reparations for damage done to Kuwait, denuclearize, open inspections of its military facilities, etc. Again, unprecedented act. The Iraqis and their supporters say, hey, wait a minute. Israel has 300 nuclear weapons. They refuse to even sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States has nuclear weapons all over the Middle East, on its planes, on its ships. You're saying that we and we alone have to denuclearize. And the U.S. says, yeah, you bet, we do. The Iraqis say, you know, Kuwait's about the richest country in the world per capita. And we're supposed to pay them money? So, yep. Yeah. So the Iraqis have been balking on a lot of these things. Indeed, the U.S. doesn't allow inspections of our nuclear facilities, and Iraqis say, why should we? We say, well, look, you're a threat to the region, you've committed this act of aggression, nobody trusts you. We're taking this unprecedented action because you've engaged in unprecedented actions. So it's been this most... It appears that most of the UN is ready to lift at least partial sanctions, saying obviously nothing to support the military. We need an arms embargo to be sure to open up at least some, make sure nothing will strengthen the regime, but at least open up to try to rebuild the water system or sewage systems or things that have a very real day-to-day, which is cause of the deaths of at least 100,000, maybe even 200,000 children since the Gulf War, from the damaged infrastructure from the bombing. Could we at least allow the Iraqis to sell enough oil to bring in the spare parts they need to at least get the civilian infrastructure going? And again, the majority of the Security Council is ready to do that, but the U.S. says, no, if you try it, we'll veto that. We're not ready to lift those sanctions. So it's become a big debate on humanitarian grounds as well as political ones about, everybody agrees an arms embargo should continue. Clearly, embargo of anything that could be used for nuclear material. Clearly, embargo on anything that could strengthen the government of Saddam Hussein. But there is disagreement on, perhaps allowing, some oil to be sold to help the civilian population. You can bring in some medical and food aid, but the paperwork to get it approved is so vast, it's often holds up food and medicine. In addition, almost every ship bound for Iraq is boarded by the U.S. Navy, and they go through everything and make sure it really is food and medicine, etc. So that makes even though that distribution slow. But unlike the embargo with the invasion of Kuwait, which was almost universally upheld, like 95%, a lot of neighboring countries such as Jordan believe that the Iraqis are being Iraqi people are being punished unfairly. So This embargo is not nearly as effective. A lot of stuff is still getting through, which is at least to help some of the population. So that's basically a real brief overview of the UN in that part of the world. And I'm happy to talk about any of the specific examples, more broader questions about the United Nations and its role, or the U.S. and its role vis-a-vis the UN.
Is it accurate to say that the Iraqi regime is holding its own people hostage?
I think so.
Appealing to the Western world to take humanitarian action?
Possibly. Saddam Hussein has never cared that much about his people. He's been responsible for the slaughter of thousands of Kurds, Shiites, and other kinds of dissidents. And therefore, some critics of the sanctions say, the sanctions are quite appropriate when he invaded Kuwait, but now they're just punitive, and people are being punished. You're not Saddam Hussein, who presumably is still living in luxury, but the masses of people there. I saw a cartoon that had Bush, but now it could be Clinton as the knight in shining armor coming in, and there's the Iraqi this damsel, which has Iraqi people tied to the stake, and then this dragon that says Saddam Hussein, holding her there. And then the knight, President Bush or President Clinton, says to the maiden, "Oh, you don't understand. I can't rescue you until you slay the dragon." But that's kind of a dilemma that the current sanctions pose.
Could you speak a little bit about Lebanon?
Sure. The UN was not very much involved in the civil war. The Arab League gave Syria a mandate to come as a peacekeeping force, but the Syrians, of course, have used that to their advantage, sometimes playing one side off against the other. In fact, Lebanon used to be part of Syria until the French kind of carved it out to try to keep a pro-Western enclave in that part of the world. Currently, the Lebanese government is one where the in a relation to Syria comparable to Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union. That is, certain key appointments in foreign affairs, they pretty much have to, get the approval of Damascus, though otherwise they're pretty much a fully independent state. It's not an occupation, per se. Where the UN has played a role is vis-a-vis Israel and Lebanon. Of course, Lebanon, like most countries, the United Nations Refugee Works, I forget what it stands for, UNRWA, the refugee group, has helped administer the Palestinian camps, though for a number of years the PLO essentially ran them in conjunction with the UN, and they've generally cooperated fairly well. In 1978, Israel invaded southern Lebanon and was pressured by the UN to pull back. In fact, to leave the country altogether, but Israel ended up with a 6 to 12 mile operating zone where it either occupies directly or has this foreign regiment called the South Lebanese Army to patrol. And the UN, which was given the mandate to go right up through the Israeli border, the Israelis won't let them. They'll just leave them. But they do sort of go between the Israeli occupied zone and the and Lebanon proper. The Israelis just went right through that line in 1982 and invaded all the way up to Beirut. And the UN passed a whole series of resolutions, or tried to, Security Council, condemning the invasion. The U.S. vetoed virtually every one of them. Even they said, let's have a ceasefire in place, stop the slaughter. The U.S. vetoed those as well. And as you know, as many as 20,000 people were killed, about 80% of whom were civilians. It was, you may remember, the pictures of the siege with shells and bombs just going into civilian areas big time. But eventually the Israelis withdrew back to that zone, and once again the UN troops have been in there. And this time, one of the ironies of the 1982 invasion was that the UN had successfully kept the peace. There had not been any cross-border shelling or infiltration in the full year prior to Israel's invasion. Israel invaded on the grounds to protect their northern part of the country from shelling, but there in fact had been no shelling for a full year. The incident that led to it was an assassination attempt on the Israeli ambassador to London, which was done by Abu Nidal, which is a terrorist group that has no affiliation whatsoever with the PLO. And they knew that at the time. But used an excuse for heavy, heavy bombing into Lebanon, killed a couple hundred civilians over that weekend. In retaliation, a radical PLO group lobbed two shells that landed harmlessly in the field in northern Israel, and they used that as an excuse to come in. And both the Democratic Party at their midterm convention and the vast majority of the U.S. Congress also came out in support of the invasion and supported Reagan's veto of any U.N. effort to stop the invasion. So a lot of U.N. people, especially since a lot of U.N. personnel were killed along with other, along with Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, have been really bitter about the U.S. role in Lebanon as a result. The UN forces there tend to be from the Scandinavian countries. They've also brought in some people from Fiji and Nigeria and a couple of other places. But it's of all the UN peacekeeping operations, it's where people like to go the least because it's the most dangerous, especially since the South Lebanese army has routinely attacked UN forces, and they're squeezed between these extremists, plus now with the PLO driven out. Hezbollah, this incredibly radical Islamic extremist group, has filled in the vacuum there. So they're really caught between some pretty fanatical groups on both sides. Last summer, you recall, Israel shelled over 100 villages in southern Lebanon in retaliation for a Hezbollah attack against Israeli occupation forces in southern Lebanon. About 100 civilians were killed, and hundreds of thousands once again fled north to escape the attacks. But the UN was unable to do it. Hezbollah ended up firing shells back in northern Israel. And this is the first time that they'd actually shelled northern Israel since 1982. So once again, people in Kiryat Shemona and Israeli towns in northern Israel, for the first time in over a decade, had to get down into their shelters. I was actually down there in 81, and I spent time in shelters on both sides of the border, in a shelter in a Palestinian refugee camp. There was a bombing where these U.S.-built cluster bombs had gone right into a schoolyard during recess and killed a bunch of children, and heavy down the shelter. Then on the other side, this is before the 1981 ceasefire, and northern Israel having to go down the shelter of the kibbutz because of shelling. But these UN people, this stuff just goes on over their heads. There's not a whole lot they can do because they just have these sidearms, really. There's not a whole lot they can do.
I have an elementary question, and maybe you covered it earlier in the week. This is my first time. How does the United States come to a decision on how to vote on things? Is it the cabinet, the president, the different parties?
It's an executive decision of the president of the United States, who transfers that information to his ambassador. Currently, the ambassador is a woman named Madeleine Albright. The UN ambassador is traditionally, it's not an official member of the cabinet, but for all practical purposes is a cabinet member. But the cabinet really meets as a big group anyway. And the UN ambassador, tends to be a senior advisor on foreign affairs to the president, but it's ultimately a decision of the president. Now, the Congress can pass resolutions that say, they encourage the president to take a particular action, but these are generally just sense of Congress resolutions and have no legal binding. Interesting enough, Congress is to the right of even Clinton on Middle East stuff. When the massacre in Hebron, when that American-born Israeli settler came in and massacred all these worshippers at the Ibrahim Mosque. By the way, it's named the Ibrahim Mosque because this is the Mosque of Abraham. This is actually on the purported burial site of Abraham. Abraham, of course, is a great prophet in Islam, as he is in Judaism and Christianity. But in this massacre, There's calls because it's basically these right-wing settlers who are heavily subsidized by the U.S. government, by the Israeli government, in fact, indirectly by the U.S. government, since we give so much aid there. About as many as a third of them are Americans, American immigrants, who live out their sort of cowboy and Indian fantasies. And they essentially play a role comparable to the death squads in Central America, that they're not officially part of the government, but they have supporters within the Israeli military that essentially let them do what they want to do, pretty much. And they've been responsible for hundreds of deaths of Palestinian civilians. And there's a proposal in the UN to have an international peacekeeping force in the West Bank to protect the population from the settlers. And the U.S. Said, we'd veto that if you even try. The Israelis actually were somewhat open. I think it was a tiny observer mission. I think they're also Scandinavians who come in, but they're not a real peacekeeping force per se. But anyway, there's a resolution to condemn the massacre, calling Israel to fulfill its responsibilities as an occupying power to protect the civilian population. And there was pressure from Congress for Clinton to veto that, particularly since they referred to East Jerusalem, which was seized, which is part of the West Bank, and was seized at the same time as the rest of it, as part of the occupied territories, because the majority of people in Congress support Israel's annexation of Greater Jerusalem, though most observers see that that's violating the international legal principle of expanding the territories by force. So what Clinton did, instead of vetoing it like Congress wanted, he abstained on two paragraphs, one which mentioned Jerusalem, and the other which used the word occupied territories, because the Clinton administration for the first time, and this is part of its distancing from 242 and 338, says these are not occupied territories, these are disputed territories, meaning the legal distinction being that Clinton, the U.S. government is now arguing that Israel land seized by, that this is not a matter that... the Palestinian Arabs, who've lived there for centuries, are not really under occupation. The Israelis and the Palestinians have equal claim to that land, and through the Oslo Accord can figure out what to do with it. Though, of course, many people say that's just legitimizing territorial expansion. The UN, the U.S. is also use the Oslo Accord, that is the PLO-Israeli agreement. Basically, Israel is very vague in a lot of ways. They put off Jerusalem, they put off the question of settlements till later. And so the United States says, well, since they're going to be discussed later, it's wrong for the UN to prejudge the matter. But the UN's already made a decision. The UN's already declared the Security Council, with U.S. approval, previous administrations, said these settlements are illegal and they have to be dismantled immediately. Because, according to international law, you cannot transfer your civilian population onto territories seized by military force. Similarly, and Jerusalem has always been seen in previous UN Security Council resolutions supported by the U.S. as part of the West Bank. It's part of occupied territory just as much as anywhere else. Not that they wanted to go back to the status quo ante, with barbed wires and snipers and sentry posts on the border, but at least maybe go back to the original idea, which was an international city or some kind of joint administration or whatever. But basically, the U.S. has been used the Oslo Agreement as an excuse to negate previous UN resolutions, even though the Security Council resolutions take legal precedent over a two-party agreement, particularly since one of those two parties, the PLO, would never accept anything less than what the UN has already said. So in a sense, the U.S. is sabotaging both the previous UN Security Council resolutions, which previous administrations had supported, as well as the Oslo Accords between the PLO and Israel, as well as some of the most important precepts of international law. So there's quite a bit of concern among international legal scholars about how the Clinton administration has moved so far to the right, believe it or not, even more than Reagan and Bush, vis-a-vis the United Nations and its authority.
I think I may have missed this, but I know from last night you're not a college professor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by your son.
Yeah.
Did you say you're involved in peace explorations, and what kind?
Well, basically, I have a small institute where I am do workshops and lectures and write articles both for church-related and political and academic publications. And basically, as some of the previous things, previous gatherings have indicated, there are a lot of very socially conscious people who care a lot about peace and justice in the world and know a lot about peace and justice in other parts of the world but are less familiar with the Middle East because it seems so complex and confusing, and a lot of people are surprised to know that where the Clinton administration comes from this and that there are certain problems that need to be altered. And I hope that this work will inspire people to work for a peaceful resolution and throughout the Middle East and the Gulf and Western Sahara and Israel, Palestine, and elsewhere. And just to make a plug that I try to do for a living. It's pretty tight sometimes, but contributions are welcome. And more importantly, if you're part of an organization or a church or a synod or something that would like somebody like me to come in, I welcome the opportunity because that's what I'm here for.
Could you part of the Syrian proposal of bringing in UN troops?
Yeah.
UN already has a presence on the Golan. How would that change?
This would be a much larger force, which would have the right of more intrusive kind of monitoring. Israel's rejected that. They want an American military presence instead. The Israelis have never allowed UN personnel on their own soil. They've only been on the Arab side, for example. They were, many Israelis talk in terms of the 1967 war that one thing that scared them was that Nasser ordered the withdrawal of UN peacekeeping forces on the Egyptian-Israeli border. But at least Nasser allowed the UN in the first place, and Israel never has. And I think it's part of this distrust of the UN, the idea that they're all out against them. They much prefer to have the EU at. And both Israel and the United States has rejected the UN as an actual mediator in Israel-Palestine. They've always preferred to have the US as the mediator. Obviously, the United States likes itself being the mediator because we can help Pax Americana. It helps our influence. And the Israelis have preferred us because we're the only country that gives them the kind of economic, military, and diplomatic support of their occupation. And so basically, the Arab states, including the PLO, have said either you do it under U.S. auspices or we won't get anywhere. And so they haven't had a lot of choice, even though the Arab states would much prefer to go through the UN or some kind of multinational body. The one exception, of course, was because the U.S. refused to allow the PLO to take part in the peace process, the Israelis realized the only way they could get anywhere would be to meet secretly with the PLO in the third country, which they did in Oslo. And that's interesting how that's the only way there's actually been progress is when they went outside the auspices of the United States to what was indeed a more objective third party.
My question is, do you have any sense of why Clinton takes the stand he does? Is it a philosophical one, or is it just because he cares less about international and more about national health care and so on? Do you have any sense of that?
This question's been asked about every session, but real briefly, my own sense is that, again, he doesn't care that much or knows that much about foreign policy, so he defers to the establishment, and the establishment that being the national security managers, the Pentagon, the strategic think tanks, etc., do take a pretty hardline position. His appointments in Middle East stuff, his top advisors, are people who, actually, a good chunk of them are Republican holdovers, actually. And some people like Martin Indyk, who's his chief foreign policy advisor on the Middle East, was a former advisor of Yitzhak Shamir, the real right-wing prime minister that preceded the Labour government. In fact, Indyk wasn't even a U.S. citizen. They had to speed up to get his citizenship 2 days before he was confirmed as to the National Security Council. So it's a pretty, I mean, his, I've said this, and this is not an exaggeration, Clinton's, you know, appointments on Middle East are the equivalent of Reagan's appointments in Central America. They're considered, I knew of most of these people before they got positions in government, and they were generally considered the most hard, and the most right-wing think tanks, the most hardline elements. But again, that's generally true unless there's a real popular movement pressuring for a more ethical, or more United Nations-oriented, or a more or less militaristic-oriented foreign policy. The tendency will be for any president who doesn't have strong convictions one way or the other to go with the more establishment kind of ways of viewing things.
Do you think there's a role for? I mean, Clinton's position on this was stated before he was elected.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you think there's a role for cultural reflection of our society and basically racist attitudes toward Arabs?
Well, very, very much so. I think it's one reason people have been a little more, I mean, Israel killed more civilians in 3 months in 1982 than had been killed in El Salvador in the previous 3 years. And this is the most repressive period in El Salvador, 1979 to 1982. But I think, you know, because the Salvadorans are Christians, because they speak a Western language, that I think there's a little more identification. I know I did. I mean, I admit myself that I feel more for Christians than I do for others, even though I believe in the essence, essentially equality of everybody. You know, just on a gut, on an emotional level, I feel that, and as I imagine most of us do. But, and of course, you know, the Christian Palestinians and Christian Lebanese have been killed as well, but still, there's, I think that might have part of it. Also, I think we have a kind of romantic notion about Israel, the fact that it is one of the few democracies in that part of the world, given the Jews have suffered so much, and unfortunately, often debates polarize, so you're pro-Israel, you're pro-Arab. It's not like you can say, I firmly support Israel's right to exist, but I don't support its right to invade and occupy. That the Jews deserve a homeland and a nation state, but not an empire, or you know, however you want to word it. So I think interrupting that polarization, I think, will make it a lot clearer. Indeed, what I think the United States should be a friend of Israel. But what does a real friend do? And I used this analogy yesterday. If your friend is at a bar, grabs the keys and staring out to the car, what does a real friend do? A real friend would say, I don't want you to hurt yourself or other people, even if it means taking the keys away. And of course, in this case, the United States isn't just the... We've not only not prevented them from driving, we're the bartender. The one there, you know, shoveling the alcohol in.
Provided the car,
too. Right. Provided the car, yeah. But
that's okay. If it was a Ford, it wouldn't make it down the road.
Yeah.
Forgive me, my
cord
just died.
I think more than that, I think there's an anti-UN bias in this country. We, the United States, have supported the UN as long as we could control it. Remember, we were real pro. Remember how big pro UN we were back in the 40s and 50s. Everybody thought the UN was great, and you had, you know, all this kind of the end thing, especially in kind of liberal circles, the UN's great. And then when the third world got the majority and the US stopped getting its way in the late 60s and 70s and the 80s, it was into trash the UN. And now that we can sort of dominate the UN again, people are into the UN. I remember seeing an article in New York Times magazine in the late 70s, what's wrong with the UN? The UN's malaise. How come the UN is always voting against us? And there's some votes that were literally in the General Assembly 142-1. You know, why is the UN always, what's wrong with the UN? It reminds me of the joke of the proud mother watching the parade go by and saying, everybody's out of step except my Johnny.
Yeah.
No. I think by the nature that we are a pioneer culture, that we're isolated, we're probably the worst of the countries with educations in terms of knowing foreign languages and, you know, how insular we are here. We don't trust the UN, fundamentally. I mean, geez, everybody there except us is foreigners, you know. it's not just the John Birchers. I think everybody has has this kind of, you know, and as long as we can run things, it's great. But, boy, you know, remember the World Court, International Court of Justice told us, you know, we've gone to the World Court all the time, from fishing disputes to the hospital.